modern historians have either slightly passed over or inadequately explained the circumstances under which the savage execution of Ghulam Qadir took place on 3 March 1789 at Mathura, 2.5 months after his capture, 18 December 1781. Nor do the contemporary chronicles provide a clue to the factors that hindered the killing of a barbarian who had struck mortal blows on the Mughal king and his family and wrought a devastating upheaval in Delhi. It has been suggested that a strongly worded letter of Shah Alam threatening to quit Delhi and migrate to Mecca if the eyes of Ghulam Qadir were not taken out clinched the issue, forcing Mahaji Sindhia, now the sole arbiter of the royal affairs, to condemn the tyrant to death in the manners delectable to the sightless sovereign. This is, however, an isolated statement, unrelated to historical setting, and does not reveal the inner side of a worrisome tale of tragedy and triumph unparalleled in the Mughal annals. It is a simple explanation of a complicated situation, ignotum per ignorius, offering no answer to a number of questions arising out of it. Sohiruddin Malik, Persian Documents Pertaining to the Tragic End of Ghulam Qadir Rohila, 1780-1789. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to Season 10 of the Islamic History Podcast. This season, we are continuing our discussion of the Mughal Empire. This is Episode 10-8, The Rohila. The Rohilas. Zabita Khan was now officially the Mughal Mir Bakhshi, that is, Army Paymaster. This made him Mirza Najaf's superior. Mirza Najaf was a Persian mercenary working for the Mughals. Abdul Ahad Khan, the deputy grand vizier, was jealous of Mirza Najaf's growing influence. Mirza Najaf's successful campaign against the Jats in the mid-1770s had raised his political standing. We discussed this campaign in the previous episode. Some of this jealousy was due to the fact that Mirza Najaf was also an Iranian Shia. And considering the problems with the Sayyid brothers, this suspicion of Mirza Najaf is not surprising. Abdul Ahad tried to convince Zabita Khan to check Mirza Najaf's influence. But Zabita Khan could not, as he was also scared of Mirza Najaf. Abdul Ahad Khan grew frustrated waiting for Zabita Khan to do something about Mirza Najaf. Hence, Abdul Ahad Khan, the deputy grand vizier, decided to overthrow Zabita Khan, the grand vizier. Abdul Ahad Khan used Zabita Khan's unpaid taxes as a precursor for war. He sent an army led by his brother to collect what was owed. However, Zabita Khan defeated this army and killed Abdul Ahad's brother in March 1776. Emperor Shah Alam II initially forgave Zabita Khan. However, when Mirza Najaf returned from the Jat campaign, the emperor stripped Zabita Khan of all his powers. Then, in May 1776, the emperor ordered Mirza Najaf to arrest Zabita Khan. Mirza Najaf besieged Zabita Khan at his fortress, which finally fell in September 1776. Zabita Khan escaped with his Sikh allies, but his entire family was captured and taken back to Delhi. Among the captives was Zabita Khan's son, Ghulam Qadir. Remember that name, Ghulam Qadir will play a big role later on in this episode. The Sikhs. Zabita Khan went to live with the Sikhs in Karnal, which was about 70 miles north of Delhi. Some reports say he even became a Sikh and took the name Dharam Singh. Meanwhile, the Mughals and Sikhs continued to fight across North India. The Mughal armies eventually wore the Sikhs down, who decided to sue for peace. In this peace agreement, the Sikhs promised not to provide shelter to Mughal enemies. As such, they had to return Zabita Khan to the Mughals. Zabita Khan begged the emperor for forgiveness, and Mirza Najaf mediated on his behalf. Well, Emperor Shah Alam II decided to pardon Zabita Khan and return his property and his family. And for a brief moment, there seemed to be hope for the Mughals. All of their primary enemies had finally been pacified. the Marathas had been beaten by the British and retreated back to the Deccan. Zabita Khan and his Rohilas had also been defeated. In fact, Zabita Khan was once again loyal to the Mughals. The Jats, having been crushed by Mirza Najaf, were now Mughal allies. The Sikhs had also been defeated. Unfortunately, Abdul Ahad Khan got greedy and proceeded to ruin things for the Mughals. He tried to drive the Sikhs out of Punjab, but they defeated him. And with this failure, Mirza Najaf began plotting to get rid of Abdul Ahad Khan. Mirza Najaf convinced the emperor to dismiss Abdul Ahad Khan. Then, Emperor Shah Alam II appointed Mirza Najaf as Grand Vizier and as the Mir Bakshi, that is, the army paymaster. It was always considered very dangerous for one man to hold both of these offices. The Vakili Mutlak, or Grand Vizier, was in charge of state affairs, while the Mir Bakshi, or army paymaster, was in charge of military affairs. Keeping them separate prevented one man from having too much power. Now, this shouldn't have been a problem for a man like Mirza Najaf. Before attaining these offices, Mirza Najaf was known as a disciplined, stoic, military man. But once he got this power, he succumbed to the vices of the Mughal court. He began drinking and getting involved with several women. And as a lifelong military man, he was not experienced in state affairs. This lack of experience was compounded by his moral depravity. Once this weakness became evident, the enemies of the empire were ready to pounce. The Sikhs resumed raiding Mughal territory. Fortunately, Zabita Khan worked with Mirza Najaf's nephew to fight off the Sikhs. And by June 1781, the Sikhs had agreed to behave. Mirza Najaf died of tuberculosis in April 1782. Listen to this excerpt describing how quickly the Mughal Empire spiraled out of control. In spite of the combined Maratha-Mughal strength, northern India in the second half of the 18th century was a lawless, dangerous place. The Sikhs raided with virtual impunity not only the kingdom of Delhi, but also Rajputana, Rohilkhand, the lands of the Jats, and even the territory of the dreaded Marathas themselves, until Najaf Khan, the Mughal emperor's highly talented Balochi general, decisively defeated them in 1777. Unfortunately, the general passed away on 26 April 1782. Within 6 years after his death, the Mughal army effectively ceased to exist, because of Shah Alam's bad judgment. He should have appointed the deceased general's nephew, a competent man whose loyalty and valor had been proven on numerous occasions. Instead, he appointed a series of worthless and corrupt, if not outright treasonous, individuals who colluded with the emperor's enemies to reduce the size of his army. The Great Mughals and Their India, by Dirk Collier. Since he had held two important positions, Mirza Najaf's death left a big gap in the Mughal Empire. Now, despite his failings as a politician, Mirza Najaf's martial skills helped to briefly prop up the Mughal Empire. He had reconquered all the Mughal strongholds near Delhi. He had also built a modern army that defeated the Jats, Rohilas, and the Sikhs. The Marathas return. Mirza Najaf's death led to a power struggle and various palace intrigues. The emperor made matters worse by supporting different factions at different times. The emperor sometimes even got involved in the violent infighting of this period. The leader of one faction was blinded, and several others were assassinated. Just like the Sikhs before them, the Marathas used this confusion to their advantage. They began sending forces into North India for the first time in nearly 11 years. As the Maratha presence grew stronger, Emperor Shah Alam II came to believe they were the only ones who could really protect him. Therefore, on 14 November 1784, the emperor did the unthinkable. He appointed a Maratha prince, Maharaja Mahaji Sindhya, as the Grand Vizier. there are no words for how this infuriated the Mughal nobles. The Mughal nobility could only barely tolerate Shiites holding too much power within the empire. They definitely did not want a Hindu essentially running the empire. Hoping to bolster his authority, Maharaja Sindhya decided to conquer Mughal lands fort by fort. However, since both he and the emperor were flat broke, he intended to use the proceeds from fighting to pay his troops, and of course keep whatever remained for himself. Well, between 1785 and 1787, Mahaji Sindhya attacked Aligarh, Agra, and the Rajputs. Now, despite all of this fighting, when he returned to Doab, Mahaji Sindhya was in the same financial state as when he started. Frustrated from this failure, he retreated to the former Jat fortress of Deeg in August 1787. Ghulam Qadir. Ghulam Qadir Rohila was the son of Zabita Khan and was 21 years old in 1787. We mentioned him earlier as being one of Zabita Khan's family members that had been captured by Mirza Najaf. Ghulam Qadir wanted to be a great warrior and leader like his grandfather Najib-ud-Dawla. He began this quest by expelling the Maratha tax collectors from Rohilkhand. Then, he consolidated and confiscated his family lands in Rohilkhand. Any family members who protested were thrown into prison. Finally, Ghulam Qadir marched on Delhi, defeated a weakened Mughal army, and occupied Delhi. Emperor Shah Alam II received Ghulam Qadir on September 5th, 1787. Then the emperor appointed Ghulam Qadir as the Mir Bakshi and Amirul Umara, just like his father had once been. The Mir Bakshi, as we mentioned earlier, was the army paymaster, and Amirul Umara was Amir of the Emirs, or Commander of the Commanders. By December 1787, the Marathas had been mostly driven out of the Doab region. Soon after that, Doab, Gokulgarh, Khurja, and Aligarh were all under Muslim control once again. But the Marathas regrouped and strengthened their hold on Malwa, Bundelkhand, Kichwara, and Mewar. In July 1788, Ghulam Qadir went to the emperor and demanded money to fight these Marathas. He needed it quickly as Mahaji Sindhya was marching towards Delhi again. But after multiple raids, occupations, and invasions, the Mughal treasury was nearly empty. Angered by this response, Ghulam Qadir deposed Shah Alam II as the Mughal emperor. Two women, Malika Zamani and Sahiba Mahal, who were two widows of Emperor Muhammad Shah Rangila, remember the playboy, offered Ghulam Qadir 1.2 million rupees if he placed Malika Zamani's grandson, Bidar Bakht, on the throne. Well, Ghulam Qadir accepted the offer and Bidar Bakht became Emperor Shah Jahan IV. But we'll call him Bidar Bakht to avoid any confusion. Well, this Bidar Bakht was in the same position as his predecessor, Shah Alam II. There was no money to give Ghulam Qadir and his Rohilas. Ghulam Qadir also went to the two widows and demanded they pay him for making Bidar Bakht the emperor. But just like the new emperor, these two widows were also broke. I'm not sure why they even made the offer if they couldn't make good on the promise. Well, having been rejected by two emperors, Ghulam Qadir went into a rampage. First, he tore off the two widows' veils and forced them into a shameful public viewing. Then, his men plundered anything and everything of value in the palace. They took furniture, expensive clothes, even jewelry from the princesses. They dug up the floors looking for wealth. They even scraped off gold leaf from the masjid. And then they began torturing the palace servants to get them to expose any hidden wealth. Finally, Ghulam Qadir had the former emperor, Shah Alam II, and his sons dragged from the dungeons. Ghulam Qadir demanded the deposed emperor tell him where his hidden treasures were. When Shah Alam II protested and said he did not have any other treasure, Ghulam Qadir had the princes, that is, the former emperor's sons, tied up and whipped in front of him. Ghulam Qadir then threatened to blind Shah Alam II if he did not give up his treasure. The former emperor then said, "Will you tear out these eyes, which for 60 years past have been assiduously employed in the reading of the Holy Quran?" Well, if this comment was supposed to elicit any sympathy from Ghulam Qadir, it did not work. Ghulam Qadir threw Shah Alam II to the ground, got on top of the former emperor's chest, took out his dagger, and gouged his eyes out. Afterwards, he had Shah Alam's sons blinded as well. When their mothers ran out to beg for mercy, Ghulam Qadir had them tied up and beaten. Some members of the royal family jumped off the palace towers into the Yamuna River to escape Ghulam Qadir. Much more and much worse happened, especially concerning the royal women. We won't mention them in detail. Ghulam Qadir managed to loot around 2.5 million rupees from the palace. However, he refused to share it with his allies who had helped him against the Marathas. Well, not surprisingly, his allies switched sides and joined with Mahaji Sindhya's Maratha forces that were assembling outside of Delhi. Realizing that he did not stand a chance against them, Ghulam Qadir fled Delhi. Meanwhile, the now blind Shah Alam II was restored to the Mughal throne in October 1788. The Marathas continued the hunt for Ghulam Qadir, finally capturing him in December 1788. Now, for a while, Ghulam Qadir attempted to negotiate a settlement with the Marathas, but the blind emperor just wasn't having it. He insisted Ghulam Qadir's eyes be gouged out. Finally, Maharaja Mahaji Sindhya gave the order. Ghulam Qadir first was blinded, and then the Maratha men proceeded to torture him. They cut off his ears and nose and sent them to the emperor. And then they cut off his hands and feet, and finally, he was decapitated. And finally, his body was hung upside down from a tall tree. Why so cruel? Now, you may not want your kids to hear this next section. After learning about this story, I often wondered why Ghulam Qadir Rohila was so cruel to Emperor Shah Alam II. Why blind him by personally gouging out his eyes? He could have imprisoned him, killed him, or had someone else blind the old emperor. Well, here's something that might explain the reasoning behind this cruelty. As mentioned earlier, Ghulam Qadir was taken captive after his father, that is, Abita Khan, was defeated by the Mughals. Emperor Shah Alam II allowed the boy to stay in the royal palace and treated him well. But there were rumors that the emperor had a sexual relationship with Ghulam Qadir. Listen to this excerpt. "Maybe it was this that gave rise to gossip of a strange bond between the boy and the emperor. Before long, however, there were rumors spreading in the palace that the emperor's affections for the young Rohila protege had crossed certain bounds. According to one gossipy Mughal princely memoir of the time, the Waqiati Asfari, when His Majesty beheld this ungrateful wretch in his royal gaze, he showed remarkable compassion. According to Najibu Tawarikh, compiled 100 years later in 1865, Ghulam Qadir was very handsome and the Emperor Shah Alam II sensed or suspected that females of the royal harem were taking interest in him. So one day, the emperor had his young favorite drugged into unconsciousness and had him castrated." The Anarchy by William Dalrymple. Maratha Supremacy and Downfall. It's important to understand that the Marathas were more of a confederacy made up of various autonomous Maratha states. Maharaja Mahaji Sindhya and Malhar Rao Holkar were founders of two Maratha royal houses within this confederacy. The highest rank in the Maratha Confederacy was Chhatrapati, which was essentially the king. Peshwa was next in rank, similar to the Vakil or Grand Vizier or the Prime Minister. The Peshwa eventually became a hereditary title. Maharaja means great chief or great king, but often simply referred to a prince. The Maharaja was higher than a normal Raja, which was just a chief. Now we have to be clear that these terms were fluid and used in various different ways by different Hindu groups throughout history. With the execution of Ghulam Qadir, the Marathas were back in charge in Delhi. Shah Alam II was so grateful for the help against Ghulam Qadir that he gave them full control of the empire. With this, Maharaja Mahaji Sindhya became the regent for the blind emperor. Mahaji Sindhya received the titles of Vakil-e-Mutlaq, which means regent of the empire, and Amir-ul-Umara, which means commander of the commanders. With this new power, the Marathas resumed their war against the Rajputs. The Marathas had also hired European mercenaries to bolster their strength. They defeated the Rajputs at Jaipur during the Battle of Pathan in June 1790. From there, the Marathas moved against Jodhpur, where they were victorious at the Battle of Mirta in September 1790. The Marathas went on to capture Ajmer in March 1791. In just 3 years, the Marathas had reversed most of the losses they had suffered against the Afghan Durranis. For a brief moment, the Marathas were the supreme power in North India. But this did not last long. Internal conflict between the Holkar and Sindhya houses began brewing, and this ultimately led to a Maratha civil war in 1793. This infighting escalated and became even worse after Mahaji Sindhya died the following year in 1794. The conflict escalated to the point where the Maratha Peshwa sought refuge with the British in Bombay. The Peshwa signed the Treaty of Bassein in 1802 with the British, and the British then intervened in the Maratha fighting and restored the Peshwa to power in May 1803. Now, with the Peshwa under British protection, the Maratha Empire was essentially finished. Just like Bengal, the Marathas were now under British control by proxy. In the next episode, inshallah, we'll see just how completely the British had taken over India. You've been listening to the Islamic History Podcast, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. You can support the Islamic History Podcast and get exclusive content by subscribing to our premium channel, Islamic History Exclusive. If you're an Apple or Spotify user, open the app and search for Islamic History Exclusive. If you're listening on Podbean, become a patron in the app and you'll get access to our premium content. You can also join by visiting patreon.com/Islamic History. I'd also like to thank Brother Zulfikar Sarosh for his research on the Mughal Empire and his continued support of the show. And thanks to all of our premium subscribers. Be sure to join the Islamic History Podcast Telegram group where you can download a copy of today's transcript. Finally, subscribe to the Islamic History Podcast YouTube channel for our video documentaries. Stay tuned for a short clip from the latest season of the Umayyad Caliphate. Until next time, my name is Muttaki Ismail for the Islamic History Podcast. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Assalamu alaikum and Ramadan Mubarak. Welcome to the Umayyad Caliphate Season 3, presented by Islamic History Exclusive. This season, we are discussing the years 96 through 105 AH. This is episode 3-8, Yazid ibn Muhallab's Rebellion. Before we get started, just want to, of course, remind you that this is Ramadan and the schedule for putting out the shows have been affected by Taraweeh and the many activities I have to partake in during this month. So I kind of apologize, but I don't really apologize for the instability in releasing these episodes. Inshallah, once Ramadan is over, will be on a more consistent path. Also, I am recording without drinking water, so if the sound is a little janky or not the best, well, you know why. All right, so let's get started with discussing Yazid ibn Muhallab's rebellion. First, we'll begin with how Yazid ibn Muhallab even captured the city of Basra. We'll be talking about two Yazids in this episode, Yazid ibn Muhallab, the son of Muhallab ibn Abi Sufra, as well as Yazid ibn Abdul Malik, the son of Abdul Malik ibn al-Marwan, the caliph of the Umayyad dynasty, or the current caliph of the Umayyad dynasty. To help minimize confusion, I will refer to Yazid ibn Muhallab as simply Ibn Muhallab throughout much of this episode, though I may switch back and forth between Yazid ibn Muhallab. But just remember, there is Yazid ibn Muhallab and Yazid ibn Abdul Malik. All right, so Yazid ibn Abdul Malik, he eventually learns of Yazid ibn Muhallab's escape from prison. We discussed that in the previous episode. Yazid ibn Abdul Malik had an inkling, he had a feeling that Ibn Muhallab would head towards Iraq. And so Yazid ibn Abdul Malik ordered the governor of Kufa to begin searching for Yazid ibn Muhallab. Yazid ibn Abdul Malik also ordered his governor of Basra to arrest Ibn Muhallab's family members that were living there, resulting in the imprisonment of several of Ibn Muhallab's brothers. Meanwhile, Ibn Muhallab, that is Yazid ibn Muhallab began moving south from Syria into Iraq. While traveling, Ibn Muhallab was accompanied by his mini Mawali and his other supporters. The governor of Kufa sent an army to intercept Ibn Muhallab. He eventually learned that Ibn Muhallab was heading in his direction. He sent an army to intercept them, but Ibn Muhallab learned about this and he bypassed Kufa and headed for Basra instead. Along the way, he was eventually joined by his brother, Muhammad ibn Muhallab. That was one of his brothers who was not imprisoned. And Muhammad ibn Muhallab brought along many of his male family members and their Mawali, and this included a formidable cavalry. So now, Ibn Muhallab's military force, his immediate supporters, are starting to grow kind of strong, kind of large. So now it is obvious that Ibn Muhallab and his supporters are heading for Basra instead of Kufa. So the governor of Basra, he had the army mobilized, that is the army of Basra mobilized, and then he had a trench dug near the approaches of the city. As Ibn Muhallab and his army approached, the military of Basra, however, did nothing to stop him. They didn't try to intercept him. They didn't try to fight him. They let him pass by and enter the city without offering any form of resistance. Ibn Muhallab entered Basra. He reached his home and he settled down in his home and people began to visit him. And then he sent a letter to the governor of Basra offering to leave in peace if the governor freed his brothers. As we mentioned, the caliph, Yazid ibn Abdul Malik, ordered the governor of Basra to arrest Ibn Muhallab's brothers. What he really wanted, what Ibn Muhallab really wanted, was to contact the caliph, Yazid ibn Abdul Malik, and perhaps work out some sort of peace agreements. But the governor of Basra refused. Here's the thing. Neither one of these men knew that one of Muhallab's relatives was in Syria, really Al Jazeera. He was in Syria working out an agreement, working out a peace agreement with Yazid ibn Abdul Malik. By the time they learned that Yazid ibn Abdul Malik was willing to give him a pass and to give him safe conduct, basically, by the time they found that out, it would be too late. You'll see what I mean in a moment. Ibn Muhallab began paying out gold and silver coins to his soldiers and anyone else who joined him. And of course, this naturally attracted a lot of people to his side. So he's in Basra, in his home, handing out money, saying, come join me and my military. And now his little army is starting to grow.